I want to talk to you about Stephen Hawking, the British physicist, cosmologist, pictured on the left there, and in particular his most recent book, co-authored with Leonard Mlodinow, or Mlodinow, depending on how you pronounce these things, The Grand Design, which was a book that made a big splash publicity-wise. It made the front page of the Times in the UK, and I think it was the front page of a major newspaper in the UK as well. Basically had this headline, you know, Stephen Hawking says God did not create universe, on the front page of these newspapers. I am a specialist in philosophy, which is basically the art of trying to answer significant questions by thinking carefully. Not a specialist in science, but the reason I think I can talk with some confidence on this matter, even though it's a book by a world-leading physicist, is that he spends most of the book doing philosophy and doing it very badly, and that actually you don't really need to know very much about the science involved in order to see what mistakes he's making philosophically speaking. The atheist cosmologist Alexander Vilenkin recently said that all the evidence we have says that the universe had a beginning. And he said this in a talk at a conference convened in England to celebrate Stephen Hawking's 70th birthday fairly recently. Here's a little video showing a satellite that was sent up in the 1980s called the COBE satellite. Cosmic background radiation measurements were taken by this satellite. We're basically going in these pictures from past to present, where blue is cold and red is hot. And you see, as we come more towards the present, there's less red and more blue. That is, the further back in time you look in the universe, by looking further away from us, as it were, the hotter it is. And as you come into the present, it's cooling down. All that temperature is getting evenly distributed over the whole universe, which is why, as some of you were coming in, I was playing the track The Second Law from Muse's recent album. Not very many rock tracks about laws of thermodynamics, but there is one. This is one of the bits of information that go into convincing scientists these days that the universe had a beginning. It's been cooling down over time, like in the aftermath of a big explosion, and you kind of track that explosion back, and you go back a finite length of time to when it all went kaboom, as it were. Indeed, this is a fascinating quote from an editorial in New Scientist magazine. I don't know if any of you read New Scientist often. It's a sort of popular science reportage magazine, and it is incredibly secular in its outlook. It just takes the sort of materialistic, atheistic worldview for granted and presents science to the public from that kind of angle. And yet, here is an editorial from New Scientist saying this from 14th January 2012. The Big Bang is now part of the furniture of modern cosmology, but many physicists have been fighting a rearguard action against it for decades, largely because of the theological overtones. If you have an instant of creation, don't you need a creator? Cosmologists thought they had a workaround. Over the years, they've tried on several different models of the universe that dodge the need for a beginning while still requiring a Big Bang. For example, saying, well, maybe there was an infinite series of Big Bangs, so we can still accommodate the evidence for a Big Bang, but we don't say there was a beginning to the universe, things like this. But recent research has shot these dodges full of holes. It now seems certain that the universe did have a beginning. Without an escape clause, physicists and philosophers must finally answer a problem that's been nagging at them for the best part of 50 years. How do you get a universe, complete with the laws of physics, out of nothing? Well, I would have some suggestions, and we'll look at some of the arguments that go into this territory, philosophically speaking, during the course of this talk. So Stephen Hawking asks, where did all this come from? Did the universe need a creator? His answer differs very much from the one that the Bible gives. For example, right at the beginning, in the beginning, God created the universe. Hawking says, no. This was the front page of the time. Hawking, God did not create universe. And he tries to justify that answer in this book, The Grand Design. So we're going to examine four different elements of this book. Hawking on philosophy, very briefly. The Big Bang argument for God, if you want to phrase it that way. A different argument for God called the First Cause argument. And then a design argument called the Fine Tuning argument. And we'll interact with Hawking on these issues and see which viewpoint comes up trumps. So here's Hawking and philosophy. As Christian philosopher from the States, J.P. Morland says, summarizing Stephen Hawking and Milodnov in their recent book, claim that the laws of nature are consistent with the universe popping into existence from nothing. And they affirm that that's what happened. It just popped into existence from nothing. The fact that many people have been influenced by the claims of Hawking and his co-author is sad to me, says Morland as a philosopher. In previous times, when average people knew more philosophy, these claims would simply be laughable because they're philosophical assertions being made by scientists with little or no philosophical training. People confuse the areas of competence to talk on things and think, well, because he's a scientist, therefore he must be competent to talk on these sort of metaphysical issues. But that's not the case. As brilliant as they are in their own field, as Morland says, Hawking and Milodnov are laypersons when it comes to the relevant issues at hand that they're actually dealing with in their book. But we live in this scientistic culture. When a scientist speaks, he's taken to be an authority irrespective of what the topic is. Traditionally, say Hawking and his co-author, these are questions for philosophy. This, you know, why are we here? Where did it all come from? Does it need a creator kind of questions? But philosophy is dead, they say. Philosophy, that's dead. Philosophy is not kept up with modern developments in science, particularly physics, and scientists, therefore, have become the bearers of the torch of discovery. A very hardline sort of scientistic view that we only know things sensibly through science, and philosophy, well, let's just write that off, it hasn't kept up. As philosopher of science John Lennox responds, Hawking's statement about philosophy, i.e. that it's dead, is itself a philosophical statement. That's a philosophical opinion, and it's manifestly not a statement of science. It's a metaphysical statement about science, that science replaces philosophy and it's the only way to know things. Therefore, his statement that philosophy dead is dead, it contradicts itself, because it's a bit of philosophy that says there's no philosophy. It's like me saying I can't speak any words of the English language. Only I just use words of the English language to say that. So obviously that's not true. George Ellis is the president of the International Society for Science and Religion. And he, responding, writing in the Times, says, philosophy is not dead. Every point of view is imbued with philosophy. Why is science worth doing? The answer is philosophical. Science can't answer that question about itself. Indeed, there are loads of questions that science can't answer. Loads of things that you need to know in order to do science, that therefore science can't justify your knowledge of these things because you have to know them in order to do science in the first place. Things like the basic laws of rationality and logic and mathematics and so on. William Lane Craig, famous American Christian philosopher, says that the professional philosopher will regard the verdict of Hawking and Milodnov on philosophy as not merely amazingly condescending. I mean, imagine all of their atheist colleagues in the philosophy of science department down the hall and so on. What are they thinking about this? You know, philosophy is dead. It's also outrageously naive. Despite their claim to speak as the scientific torchbearers of knowledge, Hawking and co. are engaged in philosophy in this book. And little wonder, given that they're so dismissive about the subject, that they end up just doing philosophy badly rather than doing it well. and Craig criticizes them for their amateurish philosophizing. Hawking also has a very unusual philosophy of science. Just very briefly, I don't want to get too sidetracked into this, but he says this in the book. According to the philosophy of science that he puts forward, it's pointless to ask whether a scientific model is real, whether it actually describes the way things are, in other words, only whether it agrees with observation. Might seem like a fine distinction, but it is actually quite an important one, because he says this: if there are two models that both agree with observation, one cannot say that one is more real than the other. One possible model is favored by those who maintain that the account given in Genesis is to be taken literally. One can also have a different model in which time continues back 13.7 billion years to the Big Bang. The Big Bang theory is more useful than the first. Is more useful. Still, neither model can be said to be more real than the other. In other words, neither model can be said to more accurately reflect the way reality actually is. This is a non-realist philosophy of science, in which science is about getting models that work in the sense that they allow us to do things in reality. They make predictions that accord with our observations, but that says that fact alone doesn't mean that scientific theories really describe the way things are, or that they're getting progressively more accurate in describing the way things are. They're just getting progressively more useful in the sense that they allow us to predict more things. But that doesn't prove that the models are being more truthful, as it were. So, bearing that in mind, it's rather odd in the rest of the book when you find Hawking appealing to this scientific theory or that scientific model as a way of undermining, say, a premise in an argument for God. Because you have to keep reminding yourself that he doesn't mean that appeal to this or that scientific theory as an appeal to the facts of the matter, as an appeal to something that accurately describes the way reality is. But that's what you would need the appeal to be in order to actually undermine any argument that was being made. If I make an argument for something, you want to contradict the premises of that argument. You don't want to merely say, well, it's coherently possible to think about things in a different way. You want to say, no, that's the wrong way of thinking about it. Big Bang cosmology or Genesis literalism, take your pick. Depends which you feel is more useful depending on what you're trying to achieve. That's a very different sort of philosophy of science than most people work with. Anyway, on to the meat, as it were. The Big Bang argument. We start out with this premise, this truth claim, which is one that I think there are good philosophical arguments for, but in the light of modern science, there's actually good scientific evidence for. We were quoting from Mlodinow and so on. All the evidence we have says that the universe had a beginning. There was in the series of physical events, if you track them back in time, in other words, there was a first physical event. There was a physical event where there is no prior physical event, because it's the first one. It's like tracking back the dominoes, and there being, well, it's the first domino, there's no prior domino toppling over, because it's the first one. So take that truth claim, and combine it with this one. Every physical event has a cause, at least in a very general sense of causality. Physical events stand in some kind of causal relationship to something outside of themselves. Well, if both of those premises are true, it just follows here that the first physical event had a cause. If there was a first physical event, and all physical events have some kind of a cause, then the first physical event had some kind of a cause. Okay? Doesn't seem too problematical, does it? But let's carry that forward and treat that as the beginning of a next kind of step in our Big Bang argument. The first physical event had a cause. But obviously the cause of the first physical event cannot have been a physical cause. Because we're talking about the first physical event. What other physical thing are you going to appeal to be the cause if you're talking about the first physical event? But if these two are both true, it would follow that therefore the first physical event must have had a non-physical cause. Now this is getting a little bit tricky for naturalism. And indeed, if the first physical event had a non-physical cause, then surely the best candidate for what that non-physical cause could be would be some kind of personal cause, what philosophers call an agent cause. Because after all, it can't be a material physical cause. It couldn't be an abstract object. Even if you're the kind of philosopher, say, who thinks that there are abstract objects, like Plato used to think about numbers, say, if you think the number three is a thing that really exists. Of course, you can't stub your toe against it, but it's a real thing that's out there. But that kind of abstract object, by its very nature, doesn't enter into causal connections with things. If there is such a thing as the number three, it's never caused anything. Okay, so what are you kind of left with once you've excluded physical realities and abstract objects, even if you think there are such things? Some kind of a mind, some kind of agent cause. So you could conclude that the first physical event had a non-physical, personal, mind-like cause. So this is beginning to sound a little bit like God. Okay? It's not the whole of what we mean by God, but it's an interesting clue, isn't it? So there's the whole argument laid out. So given that's the kind of obvious way to interpret the data that there's a beginning to physical reality, I think, how would Hawking and his co-author respond? Well, Hawking objects, look, it's reasonable to ask who or what created the universe. That's a good question. But he says, if the answer is God, then the question's merely been deflected to, well, who created God then? Who made the maker? Lennox again. What sauce for the goose is sauce for the gander. A lovely English phrase. That is, if the answer to what created the universe is the law of gravity, as Hawking will later say. By Hawking's own argument, the question's merely being deflected to, well, who created the law of gravity? Kind of, you can't evade the responsibility of answering a similar type question from the atheist position if you're going to raise that. And that's a question that he doesn't answer. But indeed, Hawking is here giving an argument that serves only to reveal the inadequacy of his concept of God. To ask the question, who created God, if there is a God, logically presupposes that God is a created entity. I love the way Lennox sometimes says, if Richard Dawkins had written a book called The Created God Delusion, he wouldn't have sold very many copies, because everybody knows that that created gods aren't real. To be God is to be the creator, not to be the created. So the question, well, if you explain the creation of the universe by saying God did it, well, who created him? It just presupposes that God would have to be a created thing if he existed. It's begging the question, in other words, against the possibility of there being an uncreated creator. Hawking's objection begs the question against the possibility of an unmade God. But this Big Bang argument that we looked at doesn't make or depend upon any claims about God, cause of the universe being either caused or uncaused. So far as the argument we gave is concerned, maybe the creator that we've arrived at the end of the argument, maybe he does have a cause. Okay? But that doesn't show that the argument that we've got is wrong. It just means you've got a further question. Actually, you could go about trying to answer that question. But the conclusion we have is certainly not a conclusion that you can hold comfortably whilst being a materialist. Because it's pointing to the reality of a non-physical, personal creator of physical reality. That's not a very comfortable position to hold whilst saying, I'm an atheist. And indeed, in context, Hawking's who made God question is irrelevant to that argument that we've been making. Indeed, it's more problematical than that even, as Craig points out. In order for an explanation of something to be the best explanation of some set of data, one needn't have an explanation of the explanation, which is basically what the who made God objection is saying. It's saying you can't sensibly give that explanation unless you can explain to me the explanation of the explanation. So it's kind of invoking this rule that says it's never sensible to explain A in terms of B unless you've got an explanation of B in terms of C. And obviously that would therefore imply and C in terms of D, and D in terms of E, and E in terms of F, and ad infinitum. You can never meet that demand. It's a demand that would actually mean that science becomes impossible, because it would mean you could never explain anything. It generates an infinite regress so that everything becomes inexplicable, as Craig says. But in fact, irrelevant and dangerous for science as it is, Hawking's who made God question can be given a perfectly reasonable answer. And this is where we start shaving into that other type of argument, the first cause argument. Given that A, from nothing, nothing comes, as Julie Andrews once famously said, and given that B, there can't be an infinite regress of causes, that was the whole problem that Craig just raised about the explanation of an explanation of an explanation issue. Given that from nothing, nothing comes, and that there can't be an infinite regress of causes, the causal buck, as it were, must stop somewhere. And theists have always thought of God as that somewhere, indeed that someone. So the answer to who made God is pretty straightforward. It is nothing made God. God is the uncaused first cause. You can't just beg the question against the possibility of an uncaused first cause. Indeed, the first cause argument says that you need to invoke the existence of an uncaused first cause within your metaphysics. But this is a slightly different issue than that argument based upon the finitude of the physical past. You could put it very simply like this. Premise one. Some things exist that are caused by other things. That's not too controversial a claim, is it? Some things exist that are caused by other things. You, me, physical events, take your pick. But premise two, it is impossible for everything to be caused. Two reasons in support of this claim. First of all, there can't be an actual infinite regress or set of causes of things. But secondly, from nothing, nothing comes, and there's nothing outside of everything to do any causing. Okay? There's nothing outside of everything, so it's impossible for everything to be caused. Because caused by what? Because outside of everything is nothing, and nothing can't cause anything. Okay? But given that some things are caused by other things, and given that it's impossible for everything to be caused, it follows that therefore something must exist without a cause. Part of what we mean by God. Okay? So, back to what Hawking would say about this kind of thing. He says, in this view, it's accepted that some entity exists that needs no creator. And that entity is called God. This is known as the first cause argument for God. which he also confuses with the Big Bang argument. He doesn't really separate them out in the way that I have. We claim, however, that it is possible to answer these questions of existence purely within the realm of science and without invoking any divine beings. He seems to say, well, that's one possible answer, but it's possible to answer this question of existence without appealing to God. It's not saying I contradict the notion of God, but it's saying I don't need it, at least. Well, Peter Atkins, who's an atheist, a chemist from Oxford University, in his recent book on being, he, on this issue, kind of says, well, yes, but he says the task before science will be to show how something can come from nothing without intervention. The unfolding of absolutely nothing into something is a problem of the profoundest difficulty and currently far beyond the reach of science. I think it will be eternally far beyond the reach of science, indeed. As far back as the atheist philosopher Parmenides of Elea in the 5th century BC, we get this metaphysical fact that from nothing, nothing comes. I.e., you can't get an effect without having a cause. An effect just is the effect of a cause. That's what your language means in this context. So Hawking says, look, bodies such as stars or black holes cannot just appear out of nothing. There's some sense to this metaphysical statement that out of nothing, nothing comes. Okay, yeah, bodies such as stars and black holes can't just appear out of nothing. But a whole universe can. Well, that's an interesting claim, isn't it? I'd be interested to see how he tries to justify that claim. Rather badly, I think. Very badly, indeed. Well, here's how he tries to justify it. He says, because gravity shapes space and time, it allows space-time to be locally stable, but globally unstable. On the scale of the entire universe, the positive energy of the matter can be balanced by the negative gravitational energy, and so there's no restriction on the creation of a whole universe out of nothing. Now, I don't want to go too much into the scientific details of this, but logically speaking, what he's saying is on a local scale, individual physical objects can't just pop into existence out of nothing. You're not going to get a planet just going, here's a planet. But because you have this measurement of positive physical energy and a measurement of an opposing negative energy, we can do a sum that kind of equals out to zero. It's kind of like, you know, plus one here, we've got one thing here, but we minus the same amount here, and that gives us zero. It's a bit like saying this. I think this analogy helps you grasp what is going on for. If I said, because I've got one bank account that's got £100 in it, but I've got another bank account that's £100 in debt. Okay? So I've got two bank accounts. One's got £100 in it. The other one is £100 in the red. Well, therefore, I have no money and no bank accounts. Because 100 plus minus 100 is zero. Okay? Nonetheless, couldn't I go to my bank account that's got £100 in it, take out £100, go down the sweet shop, and buy a lot of sweets? And don't I have two bank accounts, one of which has £100 in it, and one of which has a negative balance of minus £100? The mere fact that because we have two things that mathematically sum to zero doesn't mean we're talking about nothing on this side of the equation, as it were. Yes, sir?
Except he already cheated because he stuck the energy in.
Well, yeah, from? Yeah. It's
nothing, but now we have energy balancing each So that's right. I mean, he's sneaking all this stuff in.
Exactly, exactly. So that he's just, it's a sort of an equivocation of the fact that the sum sums to the amount zero, and that our word zero, you know, you could also use that to mean nothing. But he's like, these are some things that he's talking about that he's doing the mathematics with on this side of the equation. Quite right. So Peter Atkins makes this point. He says, there are no laws in a universe that doesn't exist. Remember, Hawking was saying, well, because there's a law of gravity at the global scale, this can sort of outbalance the other forces, and that sums to zero. But Atkins says, there are no laws such as gravity in a universe that does not exist. Okay, exactly, as you're saying. Nothing has no properties. No properties. And thus does not undergo quantum fluctuations, which is another way of saying, you know, things popping into existence from nothing, so some people would interpret it. Or as Dr. Rowan Williams, with his fantastic beard here, says, physical laws are about the regular relations between actual realities. I cannot see how they explain the bare fact that there is any reality at all. You can't explain the existence of physical reality by invoking an explanation that depends upon the existence of a physical reality, like the law of gravity. Lennox again. Hawking says the universe comes from a nothing that turns out to be a something. And then he says the universe creates itself. But his notion of a law, that a law of nature, like gravity, explains the existence of the universe is also self-contradictory, since a law of nature, by definition, surely depends for its own existence on the prior existence of the nature that it purports to describe. That is, back to this issue of abstract objects, it's almost as if Hawking is treating the law of gravity as a sort of abstract object that exists in and of itself, quite independently of whether or not there is a physical universe for it to describe, and then invoking it as a causal explanation. But again, abstract objects just, by definition, don't enter into causal explanations of things. For us to really talk about a law of gravity, seeing what we really need to be talking about is the existence of a physical system that behaves in a way that is describable by a certain bit of mathematics. But it's not as if you can appeal to that, therefore, to explain why there is such a reality describable in such a way. Thus, the main conclusion of the book, says Lennox, turns out not simply to be a self-contradiction, which would be disaster enough, but a triple self-contradiction. This is pretty strong stuff here. Philosophers just might be tempted to comment, so that's what comes of saying philosophy is dead. Indeed. So far, so good, then, I think. Taken together, this Big Bang argument from tracing back causality in the past, and this first cause kind of argument, if you combine those together, they point to the existence of a transcendent, non-physical, personal, uncaused, independent, first cause of the physical universe. That's not everything that we mean by God, granted. But which worldview does that conclusion fit more comfortably with? It's obviously the signpost is pointing in the theist's direction here. This is where I want to go away from so-called cosmological type arguments, and spend the last section looking at a particular version of the design argument called the fine-tuning argument. Sometimes being likened to if you had a machine that could generate universes with lots of dials all over it. So you could say, take the force of gravity and say, well, do we have a dial for gravity or not? Yes, let's have a dial for gravity, so one on the machine. How strong or weak should it be relative to the other forces, the strong nuclear force and the weak nuclear force, and the cosmological constant and so on. Let's tune it and then press the beep, create a universe button. You know, how would the results differ depending on what we did with the knobs and so on? Here's a little CGI illustration of that kind of thing. If we had this big universe generating machine And we set it up to represent the way that our universe actually is. So there's a dial for every law and fundamental constant that we actually find in the universe. And they're all dialed to the relative strengths and so on that we actually discover. And then we took just one, let's take gravity, Hawking mentions this, and we change it, the strength of it, by a very small percentage. And then we press the Create a Universe button. The surprise discovered by scientists since about the 1970s has been that only very, very, very minute change would produce dead, lifeless, dull universes. Maybe universes that expanded and contracted so quickly that you didn't even get matter coming into existence. Certainly not universes in which you would get complex chemistry or life happening. That a life-permitting universe is a very, very small subset of the set of possible physical universes. And in that sense, our universe is governed by a set of very unlikely physical descriptions. Hawking says, a change in as little as 0.5% in the strength of the strong nuclear force, or 4% of the electric force, would destroy even nearly all carbon or all oxygen in every star, and hence the possibility of life as we know it. Indeed, as we don't know it as well, if you're talking about physically embodied life. Change those rules in our universe just a little bit, and the conditions for our existence disappear. The laws of nature, he says, form a system that is extremely fine-tuned. Very little in physical law can be altered without destroying the possibility of the development of life. As Professor Paul Davis, who's an agnostic physicist, says, everyone agrees that the universe looks as if it were designed for life because of this discovery. Fred Hoyle, who was an atheist scientist, famously said, a common sense interpretation of the facts suggests that a super intellect has monkeyed with physics. Not a conclusion he was happy with, but he said that, you know, that's the common sense interpretation of what we've discovered. Well, as the Christian philosopher Richard Swinburne puts it in talking about his so-called principle of credulity, when to trust things, it's a basic principle of knowledge that we ought to believe that things are as they seem to be until and unless we've got sufficient evidence to think that we're wrong. And that's pretty straightforward to say, I think, because if you reverse that rule and said, no, I'm never going to trust the way things seem to be until I've got enough evidence to believe that they really are the way that they seem to be, well, of course, you'd never trust that the evidence really was the way that it seemed to be, or that it really supported the conclusion that it seems to support, until you had some evidence for thinking that. But you'd never trust that evidence until you had some. You've got another of these infinite regress problems. So rationality actually depends upon us starting from a position of trusting that things probably are the way they seem to us to be, and then changing our minds on the basis of other evidence about the way things seem to be that makes us adjust our view a little bit. But the trust is primary, and then in the presence of sufficient other evidence that we trust, we adjust our viewpoint. If you apply that kind of thinking, the way I like to explain it to audiences, the whole, if it looks like a duck, it's swimming like a duck, it's going meh, like a duck, it's pecking at bread like a duck, I think there's a pretty good chance it's a duck. Okay. Let's just kind of, let's take the straightforward interpretation of things. So we can have a very simple sort of intuitive design argument that would go like this. Premise one, this principle of credulity. We ought to believe that things are as they seem to be unless we've got evidence that we're mistaken. Premise two, the fine-tuning of the Big Bang looks like it's designed, as even atheist and agnostic scientists admit. Conclusion, therefore, important clause, in the absence of sufficient counter-evidence, we should believe that the fine-tuning is the product of design. It looks that way because it is that way. At the very least, the burden of proof is on the person who wants to say, I know it looks like a put-up job, But here's why that's the wrong interpretation. But the burden of proof is on the skeptic here, not on the believer. We can also put this argument in a bit more of a sort of academically rigorous, philosophically rigorous way. Bill Craig puts the argument this way. He says, premise one, the fine-tuning of the universe is due to either physical necessity, chance, or design. But two, it's not due to physical necessity or chance. If we can rule out those possible explanations, then by process of elimination, therefore it is due to design. Now, interestingly, Stephen Hawking would agree that the fine-tuning is not due to physical necessity. There's this. M theory, his particular favourite theory in string theory, has solutions that allow for many different internal spaces, perhaps as many as 10 to the 500th power, different consistent spaces that can be described by M theory. So it allows for 10 to the 500 different universes, each with its own different, slightly different laws. The original hope of physicists to produce a single theory explaining the apparent laws of our universe as somehow the unique possible consequences of a few simple assumptions seems to be abandoned. So you can't just say, well, it is that way because it had to be that way, physically speaking. There's actually, physically speaking, our best theory says that there's a whole caboodle of ways that it could have been. So he says it appears that the fundamental numbers and even the form of the apparent laws of nature in the fine-tuning are not demanded by logic or physical principle. It's not necessity that explains them. So here we can go back to Craig's argument, and Hawking would grant us that we can rule out that necessity option, leaving us with chance or design. Well, which is it? There seems to be a vast landscape of possible universes, says Hawking. However, universes in which life can exist are rare. They're a rare subset of all the possibilities. If the universe were only slightly different, beings like us could not exist. What are we to make of this? Is it evidence that the universe was, after all, designed? He doesn't think so. Of course not. Well, let me give an argument for thinking that it is. Bill Craig draws upon the work of William Dembski, design theorist, philosopher, who he notes argues that in addition to a highly improbable event, in order to be rationally warranted in appealing to design as an explanation for a highly implausible event, it's not enough just to point to its implausibility, to its low probability. You also have to be able to point to an independently knowable pattern, so that the kind of unlikelihood or complexity you're pointing to has this characteristic of what's called specified complexity. And it's that kind of complexity that tips us off to design, rationally speaking. So Craig gives this example. He says, in a poker game, any deal of cards is equally and highly improbable. Okay? But if you find that every time a certain player deals, he gets all four aces, you can bet that that's not the result of chance. He's cheating, in other words. And if one cowboy draws his gun, points it at the other cowboy and says, ah, I reckon you's a cheat environment. And the first cowboy just says, look, any deal that I make is equally as unlikely as any other deal. That reply is not going to satisfy our cowboy. Yeah, neither should it satisfy us. So Dembski argues that given an object or an event or a structure, to convince ourselves that it's designed, we need to show that it's improbably and suitably patterned, that it hits an independently knowable pattern. We have these two criterion, complexity plus specification equals design. One on its own is not enough. Let me give you another everyday kind of example, playing Scrabble, where you take the Scrabble letters out of the bag and you line them up on your table or so on. Supposing you took out this series of letters from the Scrabble bag. Okay? It's quite a long series of letters, so it's a very improbable result. It's complex, it's unlikely. It's one very complex possible arrangement of letters. Out of all of the possible arrangements of letters that there could have been, very unlikely. But it's not specified. There's no sort of pattern there leaping out at you, going, ah, we have to explain this in terms of design. You can easily get away with not appealing to design in order to explain that just by saying, oh, it's chance. What if you took out the letters D, O, G? Well, now you've hit a pattern, an independently given pattern. But that's not a very long word. It's not very improbable that you would occasionally draw out a short English word whilst playing Scrabble. It's specified, but it's not complex enough. Again, you can easily get away without appealing to design. You can't prove that it wasn't designed. Maybe I did do some sort of trick to cause that, but just by looking at it, you don't have enough evidence to say, oh, that must have been designed. Again, you can get away because it's not this kind of thing. If you're playing Scrabble and you draw out the Scrabble letters and they spelt out that paragraph of language from Plato's book, The Laws, it says all things become some by nature, some by art, some by chance, that is, some by necessity, by chance, or design. Well, this is both a complex result, like our first one, and it's specified, like our second one. And together, obviously, intuitively, that is something that you would have to appeal to design in order to properly explain. Or Mount Rushmore. Here's a very unlikely rock formation. Okay? Very unlikely rock formation. So is the back of the mountain a very unlikely rock formation. It's probably the only rock formation exactly like that in the whole world, isn't it? But there's something different about the front of the mountain to the back of the mountain. Not only is it unlikely, it also happens to hit some specifications. And that cries out to us, design! So Hawking says the problem it's faced with is that for our theoretical models of the Big Bang Theory to work, the initial state of the universe had to be set up in a very special and highly improbable way. In other words, what he's talking about is that the universe exhibits specified complexity, which is a good argument against appealing to chance as the best explanation here. We could say this, things exhibiting specified complexity are best explained or probably explained in terms of design. But the fine-tuning of the universe exhibits specified complexity, as Hawking seems to acknowledge. Conclusion, therefore the fine-tuning of the universe was probably designed rather than chance being the best explanation of it. Hawking's real objection to this kind of fine-tuning argument goes like this. If there were enough different universes actually existing, not merely the range of possible universes described by M-theory, but say if there were enough actual universes in existence that were all different to each other slightly, then the specified fine-tuning of our universe wouldn't be complex enough, wouldn't be unlikely enough to justify a design inference. Because you've got many, many rolls of the dice happening, as it were. You've got the probability resources there to mean that it's not actually all that unlikely that one of these many universes would, by chance, hit that specification. Gentleman before making the point that Richard Dawkins makes exactly the same kind of move, and indeed he does. So I think we could grant this. We could say, if there were enough universes, and they are all different from each other, then it might well be the case that the specified nature of our universe was not complex enough for us to trigger a design argument from it. But of course, for this to be a good objection against the fine-tuning argument, you need this second premise, You need the premise that there are enough different universes in order to get to the conclusion that the fine-tuning of our universe doesn't justify a design inference. Now again, this is, even if this is right, this doesn't prove that it's not designed. It just says you can't infer design from it. But I've got premise two flashing away here, because it's like, well, okay, I grant you this kind of, if it were the case, then, but you need to show that it is the case for this to actually be an objection that goes through. And what does he do to justify that assumption? Nothing. It's a bit like this, you know, the whole thing of, you know, Shakespeare and chimps, monkeys at typewriters, or whatever it usually is. You know, if there were enough monkeys typing away for long enough at enough typewriters, they would eventually produce Hamlet. And you can run the calculations. Okay, let's grant for the sake of argument that if X number of chimps existed, then they could type out the entirety of Shakespeare's works by chance. But anyone faced with the many chimps hypothesis, let's call it, as an actual explanation for a copy of Shakespeare's works, is going to ask themselves this question. Is there any independent reason to think that X number of chimps actually exists anywhere with enough typewriters? Okay. And if not, they're quite reasonably going to ignore the multiple chimps hypothesis and go with the one designer hypothesis. I suggest a similar thing should hold in terms of the many universes hypothesis and the one designer hypothesis. Pushing things a step further, because some people will, of course, then appeal and try and say, okay, this multiple universe hypothesis, on any physical theory of this kind of thing that we could come up with, Robin Collins points out that there would have to be some kind of physical mechanism by which the multiple different universes get produced. It's not as if just these multiple universes can just, you know, pop into existence out of nothing. This goes back to our cosmological arguments. So within any scientific multiple universe theory, you have some kind of physically described mechanism that is producing the multiple universes, and that mechanism itself has to be of a very specific, complex nature in order to guarantee that it produces enough universes that are all different from each other. Why not, you know, 6 billion universes, all of which are identical and lifeless? What is it about this production of multiple universes that means they all vary so that by chance one of them might be life-permitting, and so on? Why is it that the physical theory that describes reality, if that is the reality, should be one that is capable of producing a life-permitting universe anywhere within the ensemble of universes that it produces? Collins says, even if an inflationary or superstring many-universe generator exists, it, along with the background laws and principles, could be said to exhibit specified complexity with just the right combination of laws, fields, and so on for the production of life-permitting universes. If one of the components of that system were missing or different, such as, say, Einstein's equation or the Pauli exclusion principle, it's unlikely that any life-permitting universe could be produced, however many universes you're producing, as it were. The existence of such a system suggests design. You've just kind of kicked the ruckle in the carpet along the room a bit, but you haven't actually flattened out the problem. Even if you appeal to such a thing and say, even for the sake of argument, let's grant that there is such a thing, it doesn't actually solve the issue. It just kind of kicks it up a floor, as it were. Paul Davis, who I mentioned earlier, agnostic physicist, says this: multiverse theories merely shift the problem up a level from universe to multiverse. To appreciate this, one only has to list the many assumptions that underpin the multiverse theory. First, there has to be a universe-generating mechanism. In the case of eternal inflation, a quantum nucleation of pocket universes, to be precise. Don't ask me, I don't know. But he's saying there has to be this mechanism in place. But that raises the obvious question of the source of the quantum laws, not to mention the laws of gravitation, including the causal structure of space-time on which those laws depend. that permit the inflation. Furthermore, if we accept that the multiverse is predicted by string theory, M theory, then that theory, with its specific mathematical form, also has to be accepted as given. The multiverse theory cannot provide a complete and final explanation of why the universe is fit for life, why any universe exists at all. Neither the cosmological questions that we looked at, nor the issue of the fine-tuning, whether there's one universe or multiple universes, seems to have been in any way dealt with by, well, anyone, I think, but certainly in this context, by Stephen Hawking's ruminations. Towards the end of the book, Hawking says this: if M theory is finite, and this has yet to be proved, what he's really talking about there is if this his favourite version of string theory is mathematically self-consistent, and that's yet to be proved, it will be a model of the universe that creates itself. Now, yeah, I'm not going to say anything about the consistency or not of string theory on its own, as it were, but Hawking is either correct or incorrect when he says that if string theory is self-consistent, then it's a model of the universe that creates itself. If he's incorrect about that, then of course his objection collapses that appeals to this theory. If he's right about that, then I think string theory must be wrong, because the very concept of the universe creating itself is a concept where you're appealing to the existence of X in order to explain the existence of X. And that's just self-contradictory nonsense. So if M theory does really have the implication that were it to be true, it would describe a universe that just pops into existence out of nothing, that causes itself to exist, well then it seems to be philosophically incoherent as a theory. So either way, whether Hawking's right or wrong about this particular version of string theory, just philosophically it seems to me that he has no leg to stand on in terms of the objection to the arguments that we've been making. And indeed, Hawking admits that M theory has yet to be proved. And of course, back to his philosophy of science, he's a non-realist in the philosophy of science. He can't even actually really appeal to this theory as a true description of the facts of the matter. He would only appeal to it as a useful way of thinking about things for solving certain problems and getting things done. And it's consistent with observation. So he's taking a very strange sort of philosophical approach to this. I think because it seems to be a logically incoherent proposition, if he's right about its implications, it would never be proved. Indeed, on Hawking's own philosophy of science, it doesn't even make sense to claim that string theory is true in the sense that most people think about when talking about scientific theories being right or wrong. So I would adjust the front page of the Times somewhat like this. The fact that you would never get the front page of the Times saying anything like this tells you something about the media and our culture, I think. But anyway, Hawking wrong, God did create universe. Never going to see that on the front of the Times, are you? But still. Some more sort of red-top journalistic ways of bullet-pointing, summarising what I've been saying. Hawking's theory, self-contradictory. Big Bang needed Big Banger. The buck stops with God. Just right universe, put up job. And I recommend to you John Lennox's little book, God and Stephen Hawking, as well. Thank you very much. Hopefully we've still got some time for Q&A, and I must remember to repeat questions for the tape. So bear with me as I do that. So the question is, how seriously is this concept of multiverses taken? Some people take it very seriously, and some people don't take it seriously at all. And that some people will make this accusation that the prime motivation for a multiverse theory is to, as a sort of an escape, an apparent escape hatch from dealing with the problem of the fine-tuning of the universe. That it's a sort of atheistic escape route, as it were, from that. It may be with some people, with others it may not be. Some of it, I'm told, comes out of certain mathematical formulations of these different cosmological theories, showing that the theories are consistent, logically consistent with the existence of multiple universes. I think the key thing is that at the moment there's no direct experimental or observational evidence of the existence of such things. The whole concept of multiple spaces, as it were, existing somehow sort of parallel to each other, raises conceptual difficulties about just the fact that you can kind of picture sort of, you know, universe one, universe two, you can label them like this. In the very act of doing that in your imagination, you're sort of putting them in a conceptual space together that unifies them. And what is that conceptual space? Does it actually make coherent sense to talk about parallel universes and so on? Or that's certainly one reply that can be given. It might be slightly different with the sort of oscillating universe model that says you have a repeated series of universes. But that's why this thing about the dodges of the Big Bang theory, it's actually Alexander Vilenkin and various co-authors who think that would say that they have proved that even if there are an oscillatory series of universes, that the series of oscillations must be finite in number. So even if our Big Bang wasn't the first Big Bang, the number of Big Bangs must be finite. So there was, in the sequence of oscillations, a first Big Bang at some stage in the past. And that theorem also applies to multiverse theories, therefore, in that sense, you haven't had an infinitely long period of generating things. I think I'm at the edge of my physics knowledge there. Thank you, sir. And you know, I have given this lecture to secular audiences. I've got a podcast channel, and you can find recordings of this talk given on there. Just Google Peter S. Williams podcast. It's on iTunes or through the Damaris Trust. I gave this talk at the Philosophy Society at a state secular school to A-level students and their teachers, for example. And I don't think, I know I'm biased, of course, but I don't think the responses were particularly substantive, even from the staff in that particular situation. I think you tend to sort of get red herrings, or you sometimes find people who in any other situation would be very sort of, well, we believe what science tells us, you know, suddenly becoming very sort of sceptical and kind of, well, we don't really know what happened, whether there was a beginning or not, you know, theories change all the time, and, you know, we have to keep an open mind about what the science is telling us and so on. It seems sometimes people become suddenly a lot more sceptical about what science says. When it says something that might have an implication, philosophically speaking, that they don't like. And of course, that's something that, you know, we all must sort of guard against in our thinking about these things. So this is a question saying, at these very sort of extreme parts of science, in cosmology and string theory and so on, that really we're more in the field of philosophy than we are in the field of sort of experimental or observational science, particularly because we're in a historical science here. We're looking for best explanations. We're coming up with theories that seem to be possible, i.e. consistent, and then asking how do we judge which of these possibilities is the best explanation. And that is much more philosophical than experimental sort of process science, as it's sometimes been called. And some scientists have worried about this. Some scientists are sort of pointing out, you know, we've had string theory for 20 odd years and it hasn't made any, you know, we've got some nice, beautiful mathematics, and that's it. And maybe it's sort of stultifying the field, some scientists think. Others think, you know, this is still our brightest, best hope for eventually getting, you know, the best theory. So there certainly are some discussions amongst the scientists as to whether we're sort of going up a dead end with string theory and its relatives or not. Stephen Hawking seems to prefer M theory, but even he is saying there, you know, we haven't proved that it's even a consistent, mathematically consistent possibility, let alone got any evidence that it's true. So that's an interesting observation to raise. Yeah. So the question here is pointing out that within M theory that Hawking appeals to, he says there's 10 to the 500 different possibilities, maybe, of universes that could be described by that theory. But perhaps it's the case that as huge a number as that is, maybe that number pales into insignificance compared to the unlikelihood that you can calculate for the combination of all of the unlikely laws and constants of a needed for a finely tuned universe capable of supporting life. If you actually run the numbers, and of course we're in a little bit of back of the envelope kind of calculation kind of area here, but maybe you could show that you'd have to be orders of magnitude out in order for 10 to the 500 to even eat into the unlikelihood of a finely tuned universe. How many would you need, and does string theory even provide you with enough? That's certainly a question that's been raised. When people go further than that and start talking about, well, you know, maybe there's an infinite number of universes, well, then they're directly into metaphysics then. And I certainly think there are good philosophical arguments against the existence of any actual infinities of things anyway. So I think the number of universes that there are, however many they are, must be finite, however many there are. And so you can't just appeal to, oh, maybe there's an infinite number. And then, you know, how come it's so convenient to then just appeal to, well, maybe there just happens to be enough universes to undermine your argument for God? Well, that's not a substantive reply. So, well, maybe it just happens to be, it seems very ad hoc, it's got no observational experimental evidence for it. That's not a really serious engagement with the issue of following the evidence that we have to the conclusion it seems to point to.